Welcome to the first episode of 2022, and you may have noticed we have renamed the podcast to Beyond the Boardroom. We've taken the name from our interview series, which we will continue to do, alongside our monthly podcast, which takes you through the top shareholder activism and voting stories, as told by our two magazines, Activist Insight Monthly and Proxy Monthly. I'm Kieran Paul, and in the interview hot seat today is Jim McRitchie, the publisher of corpgov.net, which was the first online corporate governance blog way back in 1995. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks, Kieran. It's great to be here.
Now, Jim, I'm actually halfway through the very popular Netflix film, Don't Look Up. So no spoilers, please. But you describe most company representatives as like characters in the film. So please explain that.
The characters in the film are more concerned with mining the asteroid that's about to hit planet Earth for the money rather than deflecting the asteroid. And, you know, people are focused on their day-to-day concerns. They're not concerned with the long term. Company representatives are looking at their own company as an individual, and they're focused completely on that. You know, they are now increasingly looking at how their company might be perceived as impacting the environment. But that's mostly from a reputational standpoint. It's not from the standpoint of we need to be a responsible adult. And it's not from the standpoint of looking at the whole. So they're not really buying yet into portfolio theory and looking at beta as the driver of the economy rather than alpha. So basically, they're seeking alpha. They're seeking to try to make their company the most profitable it can. And that's a good thing. But they also need to look at beta, and especially investors need to look at beta. We need to look at externalizing costs as a negative.
Now, Muhammad Ali is not a name often used on this podcast. Perhaps he should be more. What's your link to Muhammad Ali?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Pittsburgh, and back then, Pittsburgh was the third largest corporate headquarters city in the United States. Muhammad Ali tried to buy a house, and he was willing to pay twice the asking price, but he was refused because of redlining. There were no black people in the town that I grew up in. And I think this gave me an insight later on when I was an economics major, because economics, at least when I studied it, basically looked at people as being homo economicus in that we acted rationally. But if we acted rationally, why wouldn't the seller of that house sell to Muhammad Ali for twice the asking price? So I realized that economics and the math upon which economics was based was all built on faulty assumptions. They weren't studying people and their values. They were studying what they think rational people would do. And even behavioral economics, it's progress beyond what economics was when I studied it. But behavioral economics is still using nudges to try to shape people into rational economic robots. Anyway, that's something of a link to Muhammad Ali. I, of course, never met him or anything like that.
And you recently published the corpgov.net 2021 review.
Yeah, last year I had this proposal to drop an employee onto the board, and that was basically, you know, Elizabeth Warren and others introduced legislation, but that hasn't gone anywhere. And in rethinking it quite a bit, and in rethinking my own history with employee ownership, I had a grant from the National Institute for Mental Health to study what corporate form would be most productive for society and for the employees. And it turned out that worker co-ops kind of fit the bill. But worker co-ops are not favored by banks and investors, so they have a hard time growing. And then when they grow, oftentimes they don't have rules that keep it a worker co-op. So if they do very successful, then the workers sell out and we go back to publicly traded companies. So the idea that I had was to increase the ownership of workers at publicly traded companies. You know, if employees have a share in the company, all the research shows, especially if they have a vehicle for participating in meaningful decisions at the company, all the research shows that those companies do much better, the workers get wealthier. There's all kinds of indicators to show this is a very positive step. And also, it would give employees a voice, because if employees get shares, then they have a voice in the company. So the idea here is to start that dynamic by having companies report who they give shares to, incentive shares. So we know that in the United States, CEOs get a lot of incentive shares, whereas line workers typically don't get any shares at all. So a few years back, companies in the United States came under the requirement that they needed to report pay ratios. And we see, during my lifetime, pay ratios have gone from 30 to 1 to 300 or 350 to 1, or sometimes much more. But I think that people don't seem to be especially shocked about that, although I certainly am, although most people don't really know those pay ratios. But I think that if people could see ownership ratios, they would be even more shocked, because ownership ratios are going to be 1,000 to 1 instead of 300 to 1 or 10,000 to 1. So the first step is to get companies to display, preferably in a matrix-type fashion, levels of shares and votes distributed by level in the company. So you'd see the executive staff maybe be broken out into tiers, so that you can then see what 10 tiers down, what do they get.
You've identified employee ownership as a real focus area this year. How have you changed your shareholder proposals concerning employee engagement with boards, and what do you hope to achieve with these new resolutions?
Mainstay filings will continue mostly at smaller companies, and this is to give shareholders the basic tools to ensure we can hold boards accountable. So that includes annual election of directors, board diversity, unopposed directors elected by a majority vote, the ability to call special meetings, and supermajority standards, and use proxy access. And on the proxy access types of proposals, one thing where I'll focus is to lift the cap on proxy access for the number of people that can participate in a group. So I filed the petition at the SEC in 2002 that led to, at least helped lead to, rulemakings in proxy access. We actually had three different attempts at making a rule to allow for proxy access. When proxy access finally passed, then the Business Roundtable, which is basically the union of CEOs, and the Chamber of Commerce went to court to overturn the proxy access rule. Now, that proxy access rule that they overturned provided for 25% of the board being elected through proxy access, where proxy access was invoked by petitioners that held 3% of the shares for 3 years. But that proxy access rule did not include any threshold on the number of participants in a group. And unfortunately, that rule was overturned. That would have applied to all companies. But now we have a proxy access rule that allows us to petition each company one by one to put into their bylaws proxy access provisions. And so what most companies have done is put something in. They've put it in at 20% instead of 25% of the board. And they've also put it in that groups are limited to 20. Okay, well, a group limited to 20 is a very difficult thing to get to, because you have each member of the group has to own a substantial portion of the company. And even the largest public pension fund in the United States, CalPERS, with $500 billion, they only own a little less than 0.5% of most companies. And they're not really an activist shareholder like many of the folks that subscribe to your publications and your databases. They're much more active, say, than BlackRock. BlackRock has never even filed a shareholder proposal. And all the major, you know, BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, none of them. So we're really dependent on smaller shareholders to take action to try to get together a group. And I think one thing that's also happened this year is there was a study that showed that directors don't see monitoring the CEO as part of their job. In fact, they basically see their job as advising the CEO. And that if they feel like they have to monitor the CEO, then it's time to get a new CEO. And I think that came as a shock to some investors who like to think of directors as representing us. After all, we are the ones who elect them. So we elect them to monitor management to make sure that the company's headed in the direction that we want them to head. Another thing to keep in mind is when proxy access passed, a study by the CFA Institute found that proxy access would benefit the markets by about $140 billion. However, that study was based on the rule that passed the SEC that got overturned by the CEOs and the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce. So that $140 billion never actually came to fruition. And there has never been a case of proxy access. Well, there's one case where proxy access was used, and that was when a founder of the company got kicked off the board. He used proxy access to get back on the board. So if we can lift the cap on the number of participants in a group that can file for proxy access, then shareholders in the company, basically employees, can work with outside investors, say Engine Number One or other activist types, to form proxy access groups, thereby run candidates without having to go through the expense of soliciting proxies. That's basically where I'm headed next year, or this year it is.
Yes, we must remember we're in 2022 now. What other things, Jim?
I'll also have a number of other proposals on diversity and plastics and lobbying and addressing externalized costs. Often I work with subject matter experts, and I'm increasingly trying to do that. So I'm working with As You Sow, the Shareholder Commons, Some of Us, and other organizations, the Center for Political Accountability. And, you know, they come up with some very innovative proposals. I'm learning a lot from them. For example, Some of Us asked me to file at a couple of rating agencies. And the filing was that they think that the rating agencies should think out beyond 5 years. And I looked at that proposal and I went, wow, rating agencies aren't thinking out beyond 5 years? I mean, you know, if you're dealing with issues like climate change, where Florida is going to be underwater in 50 years or so, then, or major parts of it, how can they be doing their job, etc.? So they filed for no action. They didn't disagree with going beyond 5 year lookout. Anyway, I learn a lot in working with others, and I'll be increasingly doing that. And I think that that's the direction that I see in the future that's very important, is investors working with think tanks and academics and organizations like Some of Us. And one of the attractive things of working with an organization like that is that they're rallying public opinion. And folks who basically tried to cut the legs out from under ISS and Glass Lewis, those who are advising funds on how to vote, they basically argued that these proxy advisory firms are too powerful, and that when a proxy advisor recommends for or against a proposal, that moves the needle 20% or so. And so they did get the SEC to pass some rules, which the SEC basically overturned. But the weird thing about it is these proxy advisor firms are not the drivers. If you look at what proxy advisor firms do, for example, ISS, they survey the folks who subscribe to them, and they ask them, how should we be recommending on these types of issues? So basically, they're reflecting what their subscribers want. And what do their subscribers want? How public opinion changes. The public says, we need to address climate change, or we're okay with gay marriage, or whatever. That is what drives the proxy vote, essentially. It's public opinion. So it's important to partner with these groups like Some of Us so that we change public opinion and move the vote that way.
Now, this is quite interesting. So how does it compare filing shareholder proposals as an individual investor like yourself compared to larger financial institutions? Would you say you're treated differently?
Yes, of course I'm treated differently. Like, I've been sued, for example. So, you know, the typical way that a company will take is to go to the SEC and ask for what's called a no-action letter, which means the SEC will take no action if the company leaves the proposal off proxy. And that's what they usually do. But if you really want to intimidate a shareholder, you can sue the shareholder in court. And of course, many shareholders might drop the proposal. Or if you're an institutional investor, then you'll hire a bank of attorneys to defend you in court. But I'm just an individual. I'm not hiring any attorneys, let alone a whole swath of them. But I've been sued several times in court. At first, I did lose a case in Texas. So I argued the case myself in court, and I did it over the telephone. This was long before COVID. And I argued how a Supreme Court case applied to this case, and the judge told me, well, they have no jurisdiction in Texas. And I thought, well, that's crazy, because of course they do. And I tried to get the transcript for that case, and mysteriously that interaction was not on the transcript. Anyway, I figured out over time how to win those cases, and so the next, I think, four or five cases were thrown out based on my arguments. So now I feel like if I get sued, I can hire attorneys, and because I would win court costs, you know, I'd be able to pay them. So over time, I've gotten more respect from companies because I do win votes. I will not be intimidated by being taken to court. And so my conversations with companies that I file at have become longer and more thoughtful, I think. So I file at BlackRock almost every year and have a thoughtful conversation with them and many other companies.
Jim, what are your thoughts on the SEC's SLB 14L rule?
Well, this is one of a few things that I worked on at the SEC. There's another thing that's much more important in the long run, but this is very important in the short run. So SLB 14L basically overturned three Trump-era legal bulletins that made it easier to challenge proposals. And I worked with a group called the Shareholder Rights Group, led by Sanford Lewis. There were three staff legal bulletins basically enacted during the Trump era, and I would actually look at those staff legal bulletins as underground regulations because they had kind of a regulatory effect. So it basically overturned those and turned back the clock to how the SEC made decisions before Trump came into office. Those staff legal bulletins basically had given a roadmap to companies for how to win in no action. They would have to address their arguments around ordinary business, micromanagement, or economic relevance. And basically, what we've seen is with those overturned, then the arguments will now be around whether or not the issues addressed are issues of a broad societal impact. So climate change, income or wealth inequality, those are examples of broad societal impact. Now, we will probably see companies now making arguments that inequality isn't some big social impact concern, and that's what we'll be arguing about. But I think since we brought up the SEC, I want to mention a much more important action that I've been instrumental in getting enacted at the SEC, and that is the recent announcement of a rulemaking on filings that funds have to make each year on how they voted. And I think that this will be transformative because right now the funds have to report, but they report in a way, it's basically like backing up the truck with a data dump that you have to sort through, that if you subscribe to Proxy Insight, you're going to get those insights and you're going to be able to figure out how different funds vote. But if you're the average Joe or Jane and you've got your 401k, you don't know how your 401k fund voted, and you don't know enough about that to ask, can't you put this fund in the 401k as an option rather than this other fund? The best you can do is, we want a fund that, you know, addresses social impacts, or we want something that's more socially responsible. So typically 401k administrators, they will tell you how much a fund has costs, you know, what their expenses are, fund performance, but they don't give you any track record on how funds vote. And I think more and more people want to know. So Broadridge, I think, did a study last year that looked at millennials and Gen Z, and basically younger generations, they're excited about voting. They want to vote. Of course, when they actually told Broadridge that they intend to vote. I think most of them told Broadridge, yeah, we intend to vote. But then when it actually gets down to voting, they're probably not voting, because voting can be very complicated. And, you know, we need to figure out mechanisms that will help those shareholders vote. One of the mechanisms that I've had, that I've been pushing for a couple of decades, is to get funds to announce their votes in advance. And so last year, for the first time, Norges Bank, they announced their votes on every proposal in advance, 5 days before the AGM. Anyway, this change to the SEC rules will require voting be data tagged, so that it'll be much easier to compare voting records of funds. And I've also asked the SEC to require that that happen in closer to real time. Because, you know, a vote that happened last year and that is now being disclosed on, oh, this one voted this way and this one voted that way, and if it happened a year ago, that's old news. But if it happened yesterday or last week, that means something to people. So my hope is that that rulemaking change is going to make funds more competitive around how they vote. That's very fundamental to the direction that we need to go, because the direction we need to go is to be able to allow people to align how they invest with their own values. People don't want to destroy the planet. They want a planet that they can pass on to their grandchildren. They want to be able to invest in a way where that's more likely to happen, rather than in a don't look up world where companies are focused on mining that meteor instead of deflecting it from a collision. We need to nudge meteors, and we need to nudge our companies so that they move in the direction that we want them to.
Finally, please tell us about your upcoming Spring Zoom series on corporate accountability.
I'm certainly glad you brought that up. So last semester, we held discussions with Mel Minow, Michael O'Leary, one of the folks at Engine Number One, Andy Behar, he's at As You Sow, Josh Zinner, he's at Interface Center for Corporate Responsibility, Doug Chow, who's a former corporate secretary at Johnson & Johnson, wears a lot of hats these days, Bruce Fried at the Center for Political Accountability. Anyway, we held with a lot of John Lukumnik and others, very high-powered folks. We did it through a university. It cost $100 to register. That registration process, I don't know what universities are like in the UK, but in the United States, the registration process is fairly complicated. Of course, if it means your career, you're enrolling in a four-year school and you'll go through hell to register and try to get your classes. But it was difficult for folks to register. It costs $100. Of course, on the flip side, very few people registered. So the group sessions lasted about 1.5 hours. Since very few registered, there was only about a dozen of the people on each Zoom call. So everyone got a chance to ask their questions. And we had lengthy discussions and could delve deeply into various topics. So in the spring, I've decided that I'm not going to go through the university. I'm just going to do it on my own. So we're limited to 100 callers or, you know, participants. But so we'll see where we go. I've lined up Leo Strine, head of basically the Delaware Supreme Court, and that's the state where decides most of the legal cases involving corporation and corporate law. I've got Brandon Reese from the AFL-CIO. I've got Jackie Cook. She's with Morningstar. David Weber is with Boston University and wrote a book on labor's capital. Judy Samuelson's with the Aspen Institute. Bruce Herbert, he's a financial advisor. We haven't lined up everything yet. I think it's going to be Monday afternoons. Anyway, we'll figure out the day and time. So stay tuned to my website at corpgov.net or my Twitter account at corpgov.net or my page on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from your audience about who they would like to have a conversation with. That will be the driver of where we go.
Thanks for joining me, Jim.
I very much appreciate it. You know, I've listened to dozens of shows. Basically, you've got these titans of industry or David and Goliath. Even your David and Goliath episode was about Engine Number One's campaign at ExxonMobil. So these all involved, as far as I can recall anyway, people using tools that could literally take out directors. And I'm really happy to be here because I am using a much more nudge type approach. Thanks for letting us give a nudge to your audience.
That's it for today's episode. You can subscribe to our two magazines by emailing subscriptions@insightia.com. And if you enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Boardroom, check out our back catalogue where you'll find a plethora of discussions with industry experts. I even made a Best of 2021 episode, so do check that out. Remember to look out for our annual review, which is coming very soon. And of course, if you want something discussed on a future episode, email press@insightia.com. I'm Kieran Paul. I'll see you next time.